Talk given Saturday, July 3rd, 1971. Those of you who were present here the last fortnight for the summer school may remember that we started on the Friday evening with a consideration of what is implied in the words I and me. What is the me? And you may recall, we saw that the me refers usually to this psychophysical organism, the living psychophysical organism which bears our own name. The body and the mind, or more correctly, the body-mind, nama-rupa. That this body, in the ordinary way we can think of as composed of atoms, molecules, organs and all the rest of it, but fundamentally of atoms. We think of atoms as matter. And it is also composed of energies, electrical energy in action, that is heat and so on. But when we look into atoms, we find that the atom really is a congeries of energies. That it is actually not altogether correct to call it matter in the old sense of the word matter, practically up to the end of the 19th century. So that the body can be regarded, not inaccurately, as a vast repository of energy. It is energy condensed, concretized, so to say. Now, in addition to the body, we have to consider this which we call the psyche, the mind. What is the psyche? Mind. These are words which are very convenient to use. But what precisely do we mean when we say mind? In ordinary parlance, don't we use the word mind as a single word to represent mental processes which go on, psychical processes, thoughts, feelings, and so on. We have no precise definition of what a thought or a feeling is, in the sense that we have a precise definition of what a chair or a table is. But what we are aware of is that these mental processes are also energetic. So that the me is a particular identifiable pattern of various energies functioning and manifesting in certain ways characteristic of that particular individual. This is the objective me. Now, it is easy enough to be aware of the body as the body. It's not so easy to understand and to be aware of our own mind. I'm using a wrong phrase in saying own mind, but it will do for the moment. And to be aware of the body in an intimate way, one has to let the mind dwell upon the body. That is to say, let one's attention be quietly directed towards this thing we call the body. And as I said, this is easy enough. But have we ever tried to direct our attention to what we call the mind, the psyche? If we try to meditate upon the mind and the nature of the mind, we will find ourselves considerably at sea. We will be very puzzled. What we will be aware of is a series of thoughts arising, a series of pictures of what the mind might be. But if we actually practice this type of meditation, we will become aware more and more truly of the nature of the mind and what sort of power it exercises. Now, if you let your attention dwell quietly and easily upon what we call the mind, it will move along in a certain stream of thought. A thinking process will take place. And after a time, it may be that another process will arise at the same time, contradicting the first one. We will imagine, as we are moving on the first stream of thought, that, I'm beginning to know the mind. The mind is so and so, it is thus and thus. And then an objection or two objections will arise, contradicting the first stream of thought. Now, it is extremely important when this happens not to take sides in the matter. Do not participate in the conflict which will arise, in the argument which will arise with two contradictory streams of thought. That leads us nowhere. If we take sides, it means that a certain set of preconceptions, of criteria, of evaluations have jumped up inside the mind and come into play on one side against the other, which means that I myself am in the state of conflict. And all conflict breeds further conflict. There is no harmony, there is no vision, no understanding, no resolution of discord possible that way. Therefore, one does not take sides. One observes the two different streams of thought as such, which appear to be opposing each other irreconcilably for the time being. Now, if we remain quiet and watch, then it is possible to begin to understand both. And in that understanding, harmony can arise. Not otherwise. Otherwise, we will always be in confusion and error because of the state of conflict. There will be fear. When this state of conflict stops because we refrain from taking sides with one particular line of thought as against another, then what we call the mind as a whole, as a unity, is balanced, it is in a healthy state, it is in a happy state. And in that healthy and happy state, it can truly understand. Then intelligence functions, not argumentative intellect. Because we must realize that in the universe as a whole, there is room for everything. Nothing can be thrown out of the cosmos. It has its place in the cosmos. What is its place? It is this which becomes clearer to us if we observe and examine without taking sides. This is the dispassionate use of one's faculty of attention. And when there is the dispassionate use of one's attention and one is at peace, then harmony is released. Where otherwise there appears to be no possibility of harmony. But there are certain things we must bear in mind. How is the mind to be in this healthy state in which it does not take sides one against the other? If we remain really awake, free from being attached to pleasure and joy on the one hand, free from aversion and grasping, free from aversion and trying to get rid of pain and sorrow on the other hand, then the mind is in a state of balance. Then neither pleasure and joy on the one hand, or pain and sorrow on the other hand, cause a disturbance of the whole person. Otherwise we are in this state of disturbance, this state of conflict, which is inextricably bound up with the sorrowful state. It is this kind of sorrow in our life which is quite unnecessary if we are intelligent. The human race, unfortunately, from the word go, has experienced an upbringing and an education and a conditioning through our socio-cultural heritage, which brings about this clinging to, this grasping at pleasure, and this aversion, this wanting to run away, to destroy what we call pain and sorrow. We can't do it that way. Our task is to learn from everything that comes into our life. And life in its totality will inevitably give both. One can never repeat this too often, because we actually act as if it doesn't. This is the trouble. We actually think and feel and plan and work as if life will give or should give only what we think is good, useful, happy for us. This is the supreme mistake. Because this unbalanced stance towards life is the very thing that deprives us of happiness. We must not mix up happiness with pleasure. Pleasure is a sensation. Happiness is a reality which is of the very nature of the mind. It is constitutive of the mind. Just as the body is constituted of bones and blood and flesh and so forth, the mind is constituted of happiness, of intelligence, of poise, of freedom. We, because of our conditioning, we think we have to attain these things, to achieve these things. Not at all. They are there, constitutive of the mind. What we have to become free of, what we have to clean out, is the distortion of the mind, fear in the mind, confusion in the mind, and so on. And the clearance is effected simply by being observant without taking sides, one way or the other. The whole thing works itself out in the mind. When this happens, you will find that the particular shapes which are set up by desire of how we would like our circumstance and situation to be, all those shapes vanish. Because if we raise up those shapes, we raise them up moved by our ignorance, our greed, our grasping, our resentments, our ambitions, our envy, and all the rest of it. And they are invariably shapes which are doomed to failure and to perpetuate the sorrowful state, the unbalanced state. We will be free then of all our wishing this was like this or that was like that, instead of what it actually is. We must learn to look at what actually is without taking sides. And when we look that way, the mind is more or less unified. It is calm. It is intelligent. It sees the truth of all that is involved in the whole situation. And in seeing the truth of it, really seeing it clearly, whatsoever is right action associated with that seeing will inevitably emerge. You see, this involves a great deal. Because when we don't take sides, we say to ourselves, I'm not going to take sides, I'm just going to observe. When I, being what I am, and am trying to observe what is, all sorts of reactions will come up in my mind as I am observing, in the act of observing. Those reactions will bear the stamp of all my conditioning, of my actual state of fear, of confusion, of ignorance, and so forth. Again, if I do not react to what I see coming up in my own mind, but just become intensely aware of it. I will see just exactly what my nature is like. Self-knowledge grows. And if the seeing is intense enough and complete enough, all impurity gets washed out. And the mind is clean and pure, transparent. And you will find that the mind becomes completely empty, empty of all assumptions, preconceptions, prejudices, biases, none of which have any warrant whatsoever in terms of the whole truth. This is very difficult to see, very difficult indeed to do. But this is our task. Now, if one does meditate every day, all day if possible, therefore you'll see that by meditation I don't mean sitting cross-legged and shutting your eyes and going through a verbal ritual. This is what most people mean by meditation, going through a verbal ritual inside. That may help some people to a very slight extent, but it doesn't take you far. Therefore, meditating all the time means remaining observant all the time, remaining attentive all the time. That is what I mean by meditation. Now, if we will meditate every day, all day, in this manner, observing every situation as it comes up, being very observant without taking sides in our business, in our ordinary domestic duties, in our conversation, in our study, in our planning with regard to the particular work in hand and all the rest of it, you will find that the mind will shed all its illusions. All kinds of delusions also from which we suffer regarding what we call our self in relationship to other selves and in relationship to all objects and the totality of the world in which we live. They will be shed. They will just dissolve away. They'll fall off. They will disperse like a cloud disperses. These are only cloud shapes in the mind, and they will disperse. And as one sees things truly, then this extraordinary sensitivity which characterizes the living psychophysical organism comes to fruition. Now, you may remember that for the last 3 or 4 years we have touched upon this business of sensitivity. I like to regard mind, or to approach the understanding of the nature of mind, as a receptive, responsive sensitivity which characterizes the living organism. It is a sensitivity. Here is a living organism. We know a very little about it, despite the vast quantity of knowledge we have acquired so far, about the body certainly, and about the mind partly. We don't know all about it. Here is this living organism. And this living organism is receptive to stimuli and influences and forces. It is receptive to stimuli and forces and so on, coming to the organism from outside and also emerging from within the organism.
because of stored up experience, knowledge, memories, desires, anticipations, and all the rest of it. See? It is receptive to all this. And it is responsive also to it, to all these stimuli. But it is not truly responsive. The bulk of humanity merely reacts blindly, inevitably. It is like a machine almost, instead of like a living organism, a living being. But let us try and understand that this which we call mind is a receptive, responsive sensitivity. Now, what prevents correct receptivity? That is, truly seeing, truly hearing, truly touching or tasting or feeling or thinking, as we call it. And what prevents a true response from a self-responsible, intelligent, awake human being? What prevents the true response, and instead we go through this mere reaction? Our mind is full of all kinds of ideas, beliefs, convictions. It is full of various fears, of ambitions. It is driven by unfortunate desires and so forth. And this intellect, which is but a tool which we have to use, has become the slave of desire to such an extent that it can no longer fulfill its proper function of true perception. Intellect structures everything, gives it form, shape, mental form and shape. So this sensitivity which characterizes the living organism is unhealthy. The mind is sick. This is our difficulty. This is our trouble. This lies at the root of the continuous sorrow and confusion and frustration which we suffer from throughout our lives. But let us learn to meditate, as I suggest, in terms of pure observation, without taking sides, being wholly attentive, wholly awake. When one is wholly attentive, the selfness which besmirches our attentiveness is out. And when that isolative self-consciousness, selfness is out, then the observation becomes true observation, pure observation. And then this sensitivity really comes to flower. It begins to thrill, to vibrate, to be alive, to be awake. And for the first time, we experience what it means to be a man, a human being. Not a subhuman. This is the great thing. This sensitivity comes to life. Bear in mind again, the healthy mind is the happy mind. The healthy mind is the one which is in poise, balanced. And when this operates, and this sensitivity comes to fruition gradually, quickly, as the case may be, then both the masculine and feminine aspects of the mind, if you like, call them the positive and the negative aspects of the mind, in each and every one of us, be we men or be we women, are functioning in perfect harmony, perfect cooperation. This true union of the positive-negative aspects of the mind, this male-female parts of our own mind, is the marriage made in heaven. This is the continent mind, the wholly self-contained mind. Self-contained not in the sense of in the exclusive sense of being cut off from what we commonly describe as outside ourselves. On the very contrary, in becoming the true individual as a single organism, one has become a true individual in terms of the totality. Because there is no such thing as true individuality if this living psychophysical organism is not awake to its complete interrelationship with the totality. It's very important to see this and understand it. If one can live even in some reasonable measure in this way, you will find a wonderful power of compassion emerge out of your own being. Compassion never emerges where there is selfness. But in those states when we ourselves, however selfish we are in the ordinary way, but there are states when we are free of that. There are lovely moments when we are free of that. When we are free of that state of selfness, and there are no barriers between what we commonly call self and not self, then the fountains of compassion flow freely in and through the individual towards anything and everything. It is an inclusive thing. It is not a merely reciprocal relationship. It is an absolute relationship and activity. And in this compassionate state, you will find that all the opposites, so-called, are rightly related to each other. And not only are they rightly related to each other, but you in your awareness have transcended each of the duals as such, having rightly related them, and you live in awareness in that transcendent state which is beyond both these. Beyond but not away from. Other than, more than, and yet all this here in the realm of duality is completely subsumed in that transcendence. Because a new dimension of being and consciousness has emerged out of what we call mind. No longer is it a case of our mind, my mind, your mind. It is a case of mind, pure mind as such. It is like space. No one can chalk out a volume of space and put his name and address upon it and say, this is my space. Can't do it, even if he wanted to. Mind is like that. That is the reality of mind. In the case of the body, it is somewhat different. Whatever the one total reality is, this mysterious transcendent energy which becomes, which throws out this appearance of the total universe, whatever that is, it has this extraordinary power amongst innumerable other powers, that it can become so concretized, and it has been so able to throw up living organisms called human beings, that these human beings, functioning by means of their senses and the brain, are aware of variety and distinction and separateness. This is the extraordinary thing. And this is where we begin with the body, with objects, with things which we call matter. But it is in actual fact, when you yourself are at peace and in poise and awake, it is a fact that this transcendent energy is this all. To deify, to make divine or God, is the same as to reify, res re, a thing. The Latin word for thing, res, to reify, to make godly, is the same as to make materially. There is no difference in ultimate reality, in ultimate fact. We say, this is my body of ourselves, and we refer to other people as this is his body or her body. What is this living body? And here comes a great tragedy. Most of the disciplines which have come down to us as our cultural and religious heritage have decried the body. Have despised the senses and sense functioning and sense activity. And this is a mistake. That part of our religious teaching which points out clearly that we must not misuse the senses or spinelessly indulge the senses, that is obviously correct, because that is the way of squandering energy. If you inherited £1,000,000 today and you just wasted it uselessly, how foolish and how unfortunate. You squandered it. But to use it rightly, that's a different thing. Now it's the same with our senses and our total sense life. We squander our life energy in the misuse of the senses, the indulgence of the senses. That part of the teaching in the religions is right. But then some failing to see the whole truth have gone to the extreme and despise the body, despise the senses. We talk about the world of the flesh and the devil. Is it the world of the flesh and the devil? Or is it the world of the flesh and God? Or is it the world of the flesh and God and devil? And when I have ceased to take sides out of my smugness and self-esteem with God against the devil, when I have ceased to do that, both God and devil disappear, and the one transcendent total reality is present, in which everything is a harmonious whole. And then through this very thing, the body, transcendence is made manifest. It is not as if transcendence is a something which manifests through a body. Transcendence is the body. The body is transcendence. If you can awaken, fully awaken to it, and get free of this pathetic separation between matter and spirit and body and mind and good and bad and all the rest of it, so-called, then the reality will be there. And in that reality, there is perfect harmony. But, as I said before, as you all know yourselves already, we must get free of our petty little ideas, our little pictures of reality, our pictures of goodness, truth, beauty, love, wisdom, and all the rest of it. They may be charming and attractive, but after a time, you say, well, you put it into the waste paper basket or send it to the junk shop. That's about all. The living reality is the living reality. Total, complete, transcendent, whole, physical. The physical physis, nature, is the feminine, the negative aspect of the positive, which we call God or Brahman or the Absolute or Transcendence or what you will. And when you and I have ceased to take sides and see wholly and completely, then this separated, isolated, self-conscious I is transformed into the one and only I that there is, the totality, the total reality. Something else has happened. Purpose, fruition, fulfillment, all these have meaning only in a limited context. In the context of totality, there is no such thing as purpose. It just happens. There is no meaning to purpose in the context of totality. In the limited context, there is purpose. Our limited context, this planet, and we, human beings, mankind, will then have fulfilled our purpose, the purpose of our existence, if this emptiness, which means the utter purity and cleanness of the mind, this fruition of this sensitivity of the living organism, has been allowed to emerge. Don't try to remember the words, the thoughts, the ideas, because then we only collect another heap of rubbish, words and thoughts and ideas. But if you and I are paying attention all the time, really intensely attentive, a real transformative process goes on. Because you see, you and I are actually energies at play, fundamentally. The ultimate real is perhaps best described as, or best named as, energy in modern times. That energy was named Brahman in India. It was named Yahweh by the old Kabbalists. This is before the days of Abraham. The Kabbalah is as ancient as anything can be. As far as I'm aware, there were two presentations, slightly differing in form, one from the other, spread right across the old world, from China to the shores of the Mediterranean and Egypt. One form presented things this way, the other form presented things that way. The Kabbalistic presentation, which was intensely conscious of energy and power in play, released the in its personalistic forms the great monotheistic idea. You find all the religions which sprang up in Iran and westwards, they are monotheistic, intensely monotheistic. And in China and India, I don't know so much about China, but certainly in India, what they presented as Brahman, as the ultimate creative energy, the thing about which you can't talk, and so forth, it came out not merely in terms of power. The power aspect began to be soft-pedaled more and more, but the wisdom and love aspect came out. Now this was great practical wisdom to do this, to put it out this way. Because as you all know, power is inevitably and invariably misused. And it works destructively, unless and until there is the perfect harmony of wisdom and love. And this wisdom means that this sensitivity which characterizes the living organism, each and every one of us, is allowed to come to fruition. Then, as we say in common parlance, each one of us is wise. We have understanding. And it is when there is understanding that this thing, compassion, as I said earlier, flows out freely, without let or hindrance. This compassion has no sentimentality in it whatsoever. It is not an emotional thing. And obviously it is not a thought-out thing. Because the thought-out thing has no creative pulse to it. It is a put-together. Not something alive, creating all the time. Compassion is understanding love.
if you like to put it that way.
It is love which has complete understanding involved in it. And when there is this almost inseparable unity of love and understanding, then that love can do no wrong whatsoever it does. And whatsoever it does will always be the right thing. But whatsoever it does will have very little relationship to what I, in my state of ignorance and confusion and slavery to desire, would do in the name of love. This is the difference. This love makes no demands whatsoever, has no expectations whatsoever, is entirely free of all possessiveness. It is not a reaction, and it does not suffer from any form of reactiveness. It is infinitely resilient. It is perpetually responsive. It can never be hurt. It can never cause hurt. It is unknown, unknowable, transcendent, but it is there. And it functions through the individual living being. And it is this love which is the real meaning of eros, of karma. And it is this love, eros or karma, which is the creative power throughout the universe. This love is careless. It's not careless in our stupid, miserable human sense of the word, careless. We see a little bit too much of careless love all the world over. But it is careless. It is utterly free. It is utterly blissful. And that is why it's activity in creation has been called in the great religions the Leela of the Lord, the play of the Lord, carefree, happy, blissful. But you see, you and I in our everyday life can realize this. It can never be realized if we seek it, if we chase it, if we try to grasp it. Because whatsoever I try to chase or seek or grasp is immediately imprisoned in a thought form of my making. I make a thought about it, a picture of it. I misuse my imaginative faculty, so that it is not a creative imagination, but an imagination which deludes, misleads. This transcendent love, which is the Leela of the Lord, as we say, just functions by itself. I never know it, and I must never seek to know it. I must never ask, what is this thing? Let me look at it. No. Unless by the word thing, I mean the one and only thing, the total universe. And I can't see the total universe ever. But you see, this is bliss. This is happiness. Simple happiness. It's utterly simple. It's everywhere. Here, there, everywhere. Nowhere is it not. Because this is of the fundamental nature of energy itself to do this. You see how through the body itself, with the use of the senses, with the right use of the senses, transcendence is realized. Here, inside here, you don't have to go out. So, meditate upon all this. The nature of the mind. What is this thing I call the mind? And don't take sides with any stream of thought about the nature of the mind which may arise. And then you will awaken to the fact that this is mind. And you will never be able to define this. Because all definitions are dependent upon the particular way in which the senses function. We define things in accordance with the way in which the eyes enable us to see, the ears enable us to hear, the skin and body enable us to touch, and so forth. You see? The analytical way. The senses are restricted in what they allow to enter into our whole being. They restrict. But if we understand that this is how it is, this is a sight impression, a sight consciousness, as Buddhism presents it, an auditory consciousness, a tactile consciousness, and so forth. And if we remain poised and quiet, all the sense functions are pacified. They are at peace. Otherwise, they all jump up and demand attention exclusively for themselves. Look at me, sir! Look at me, sir! They all shout. You see, some of them are rude enough not even to say, sir. You see? And, of course, this is where one is just bowled over. But if we are quiet, and the sense functioning and the sense consciousnesses are all pacified, this profounder aspect of this sensitivity, the unified mind, begins to emerge and function. And when that unified mind emerges and functions, all the sense impressions one begins to see for what they really are. Look, you can practice this every day of your life. All day long, whilst you're working, walking in the street or passing by shop windows, you see objects. Now note carefully how you see the object. Not purely from the mechanical point of view of light rays being reflected from a solid body entering your eyes and making a picture, or rather making a stir upon the brain cells at the back of your head. Not merely that way, but note all the desires and thoughts which arise at the same time, the reaction. Oh, I don't like that hat. Why? Wherefore? All the reasons will crop up. And if you just watch them and become aware of them all, you'll become aware of all your particular criteria, your judgments, your evaluations, your conditioning, and therefore your bondage. See, this is what you become aware of. And you become free of it. Now, look at that object again, and again, and again, all the time awake to what is happening here. And bless your soul, you will see that object differently each time as you go on. This is the extraordinary thing. You will see it differently. The time will come when, with sufficient, at least sufficient freedom from the conditioning in our own minds, we will see the object exactly for what it is. But the words we will use will be the same words. That object in the window is a hat, an article which you put upon your head when you go out in the street or whatever it is. The words will be the same, but your knowledge of it will be quite different. That is the curious part of the story, the wonderful part of it. Your knowledge of it will be quite different. And the effect of that object upon you will be one which doesn't bind you in any way whatsoever. You're utterly free, you're at peace. Then you can look at the hat and be perfectly happy. And not need a pill or two to counter the effects of your dislike of the hat. But this happens with all our senses. What does that mean then? That we live sensibly for the first time. Until then, we are not sensible. We are a little bit senseless. Foolish. Then we live sensibly. And then the real happiness of the use, the right use of the senses comes into our life. There is real happiness there because the mind is healthy, it is balanced, it is elastic, its tone is fine, and it is a happy mind, a peaceful mind. And when we live sensibly that way, every single sense activity is our instrument for communion. What is communion? Is it not being in whole and complete relationship with the object or the person or the situation or the event, whatever it may be, a very pleasant event or a terrible turmoil? But you will be in total and complete relationship with it. And that complete and total relationship is possible because this isolative, separative selfness, this wrong type of self-consciousness is out. You are really paying attention. And there is no I consciousness hindering the paying of the attention. You really attend. And when you really attend, you really understand. You can really be helpful. By the mere act of attention, you are helpful. Because remember, mind is an energy. A tremendous energy. And when one is attentive that way, this energy functions without obstructions, without distortions. This is meditation, isn't it? This is yoga, isn't it? This is communion, if you like. This is the pure state. It is the happy state. It is the human state. So now, perhaps we may get some sort of sense of this, of the true nature of compassion and of wisdom, which supremely characterize the pure human state. The thing which must not be pictured by the mind. Because then we restrict it. But if our mind is pure, empty, transparent, wholly alive and awake, then oneself is in the unresisting state to this transcendent compassion and wisdom, which function through the human being as such, you yourself.